Welcome to The Mama Retreat, a podcast dedicated to respite for mothers and women alike through authentic and vulnerable conversation about life experiences. I'm your host, Brittany Miller, and I'm so glad we can share this break together today.
I'm here with my husband, Colton, and he's going to teach us a little bit today about the man's brain and what things he's learned from his journey through addiction and recovery, and maybe a little bit about what he wishes other women would know. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast, Brittany. I am honored to be here with you today, and I'm actually excited to share a little bit of my slash our story because you're a big part of it.
So you should be, you should ask me any questions too that you want.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll keep that in mind.
I have some bullet points though.
Okay.
Maybe to start a little bit with your journey into addiction. Would you call yourself an addict? What made you decide whether you would call yourself an addict or not? How does that look?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that don't think pornography is addictive or that pornography addiction is real, but I just don't agree with that because of the way that it affects your brain and the chemicals that are released when you view pornography coupled with masturbation, and it affects your brain in the same way that taking in a substance and getting a high affects you, and then using that same dosage over and over again, eventually it doesn't create the same reward in your brain. And so in that sense, absolutely pornography can be addicting, and pornography addiction is real. Not for everybody, but...
Yeah. Did you learn that from a therapist or from the internet, or both?
Probably the first time I learned about that was in high school after going and talking with a bishop about struggling with pornography. He gave me a book to read called He Restoreth My Soul, and I remember it talking about dopamine and the reward system of the brain. It even shared this one analogy of, I can't remember if it was like butterflies or it was some kind of insect, that it emits like a pheromone that attracts its mate, and there was some type of, wasn't a pesticide or anything, but there was a man-made substitute chemical or something that was a little bit more powerful than the pheromone emitted from the actual insect that it could actually mate with. And the study found that the insect that was exposed to the man-made version that was more powerful didn't want anything to do with a real thing in the same environment. So I remember learning things like that in high school, and emphasis on those things when I started going to therapy and stuff as well, too.
Yeah. I guess it's important to know that it's not... I had a experience. I had a high school boyfriend that...
What?
Yeah. Somebody before you. I had this high school boyfriend that told me, all right, listen, I was like pretty self-righteous in high school. I also had some things wrong with my brain that made it so that I clung to people who were codependent. Anyway, I had a boyfriend who was codependent, but he like told me at one point that he was struggling with pornography, and in like in your culture, it's pretty taboo to view pornography. It's something that's viewed down upon and whatever, and probably likely shamed in his life. And anyways, I remember him being like, I just want you to know I'm struggling with pornography. And I was just like, I freaked out. I talked to his mom. I don't know. I was close with his mom. But his mom, like, the first thing he told me, which actually has stuck to me, is that pornography is not about sex. And I was like, oh, it's not? But I guess in that vein, once a pornography addiction becomes overused, or once pornography viewing becomes addictive, then it really isn't really about the sex anymore. It's about the brain. and what's happening with the brain. Anyway, but yeah, what do you feel like, what's been your journey then with pornography usage? And how has that impacted you?
My first exposure when I was 8 years old, and this was shortly after I had been baptized, I was playing in the neighborhood in Manti, Utah, where I grew up with a buddy. And we didn't realize at the time, but we were actually trespassing on one of the neighbor's properties that had this old barn. And we found these matchbooks, and we had this can or this tin with some dirt in it, and we were finding worms and sticking them in this tin full of dirt, and we were burning the worms with matches. That's how mature I was when I first got exposed. We ran out of matches, so we went to look for another matchbook, and as we were... This barn wasn't used as a barn anymore. It was more like a storage unit, like a hoarder would use a barn. And we looked, and really all I remember is there was a dresser that we found, and we looked through all the drawers, but all I can remember was what we found in the bottom drawer, and it was just stacks and stacks of magazines with things on them or in them that I'd never seen before. And it actually turned into kind of a... Yeah, that neighborhood kid told several other neighborhood kids, and eventually there was several kids in the neighborhood going over there. And anyways, I had just been baptized. I knew that somehow, some way, I was doing something wrong, and there was this little, like, super not very put together well treehouse across the street from my house. We called it a treehouse, but it was like probably five boards nailed to the tree with one little crappy piece of plywood. And I remember saying a little prayer, like telling Heavenly Father I was sorry for going to the barn and I was never going to go there again. And that was actually a good experience, and I didn't ever actually go back there, so I kept my word. And I don't know what happened in the years following that, and I don't know exactly how old I was, but sometime in middle school, in my early teens, or mid-teens, anytime I would be home alone, I just started searching things on YouTube, and I didn't have access to any actual pornography. It was just like explicit pornography. This was back before there was iPhones and all of the nasty websites that we have around today, or maybe they were around and I didn't know about them, but all I had was YouTube. And one time my parents came and talked to me, and because my oldest sister had looked at the search history and showed my parents, and anyways, I had a talking to by my parents. I remember my dad took me on a drive, and we like parked outside of the temple in the car. And I don't even remember really what was all said, but I don't remember. It wasn't like awkward, but I remember feeling uncomfortable.
But it's safe to say you grew up in a very religious household.
Yeah, definitely religious. My mom would always get us up early before school, and we would read like a chapter out of the Bible or the Book of Mormon. And every Monday night was family night, and we went to church every single Sunday, and church was 3 hours long back then. But yeah, it'd be safe to say that for sure. But looking back, and this is one thing that I've talked about with my therapist a lot, is there was literally no discussion about sexuality or even body parts that I can even remember. And to continue with the story, so my sister told my parents talked to me. It stopped for a while, and I just remember there was one or maybe two times that I think my mom like caught me masturbating, and this was without viewing pornography or anything. And I'm not trying to make my parents look bad or anything, but they basically told me I was doing something wrong. And really, I was just self-soothing at that point in my life. And so I felt ashamed that I was doing something with part of my own body. And that's where that as well as a lot of the other experiences and things that were taught in the church and by people around me, especially ecclesiastical leaders, started making the path to overcoming pornography that much more difficult. And it cropped back up freshman, sophomore year of high school. I know sophomore year of high school, I struggled with it a lot. Junior and senior year, I don't remember ever viewing pornography, but I was dating and preoccupied with sports and distracted with a lot of other things. So I didn't really have, I guess, the downtime, or not the downtime, but it wasn't something that I was caught up in. So junior, senior year, and then 2 years of my mission, that's a 4 year gap where there's literally no pornography use. And I thought when I got home from my mission, hey, I haven't viewed pornography in 4 years. I'm good to go, baby. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to turn back to it. And I can't remember when, but within a couple of months of being home, sure enough, started viewing pornography. And that's also when me and you started dating. So hopefully this isn't too difficult for us to discuss, or it's not like you haven't heard this stuff before.
And no, I know. And I'm in my own healing journey.
And just as a disclaimer too, maybe there was one time or two times that maybe Brittany caught me viewing pornography. But if there were 12, 13, 14 times, if there were 10 times that I struggled with viewing pornography coupled with masturbating to it of my own volition, always because I would feel bad or I would feel ashamed, I would come to Brittany and tell her that I was struggling with it. Not that helps her, because I'm literally...
Are you talking about in the course of our whole marriage, or are you talking about in the course of
in our whole marriage, yeah.
Yeah.
And not that... It's just... It's not a good thing overall, but it's better than you always having to find out and then catch me in the act and then tell me that I need to fix it.
And then...
Or you could tell me your perspective.
Yeah, in this betrayal trauma group I went to specifically for these types of situations, a lot of the women that were there, the pornography usage is one thing, but usually coupled with addictive behavior is lying, deceitfulness, untrustworthiness, and a breaking of trust. And so that over a course of a period of time really damages a relationship and a marriage. The other thing in the betrayal trauma group that we talked about was not, it's like we can't pit one's pain against another person's pain, because pain is pain. When you feel pain, it's the same regardless of a spectrum that you want to put it on. It's painful. Right. And so, yeah, somebody might say, oh, maybe it was a little better because your husband wasn't lying and deceitful about everything. I know for a fact that there's things you haven't disclosed to me. Or you didn't go back and go, okay, I did this on this date and this date. It came in waves. But I don't want to say, oh, my situation was better or easier because you disclosed things to me. But it does make it different.
I think, like what my therapist has said to, I think, both of us at one point, is that, yeah, it doesn't make anything better, but I think it provided a little bit different, I guess, timeline for our healing to occur.
Tell me then about your therapy journey. When did you start therapy? Why did you start therapy? How has therapy been?
Yeah, and maybe I'll backtrack just really briefly into my story, our story, because we had different church bishops or ecclesiastical leaders while we were dating, and I was working with mine, and he knew that I was struggling with pornography, and you had also told your bishop that I was struggling with pornography.
Because at this point, we're like dating to get married. We're not dating to just, oh, we're friends and like hanging out. We were seriously discussing marriage.
And we may have even been like weeks away from being engaged, or maybe we had been engaged. I can't remember.
No, we hadn't yet.
But my bishop was like, you should just get married before you even leave to go and do sales this summer and tell them what your bishop told you. Yeah,
the timeline here, here's the timeline. Colin and I both served missions for our church. During a mission in the LDS Church. You don't date. You don't even do secular things like view movies or listen to music other than worship music and that kind of thing. And so it's quite a culture shock going from 18 months or 2 years of 24/7 being dedicated to spirituality, to service and those kind of things, to going back into the real world where you can listen to music, you can watch TV, you can date, you can do all these things. And it's expected of people that when they go back from their missions that they're going to continue to foster these righteous habits that they've developed over a period of 2 years, but also that you'll go to school, get an education, and then eventually date and be married and have all those joyful things that come with that. But so Colton and I got home like Halloween. It was like a couple days before Halloween. And then we got home the same time, which was cool. And I'm pretty sure that's how all of this worked out. Otherwise, I don't think we would have worked out. I don't know, maybe. I'm hopeful that we would. I'm hopeful that we would have found each other even if we went home different transfers. Mm. But and then I think I reached out to you on Facebook, or you reached out to me, and we exchanged numbers and then went on a date. And our first date was awesome. It was so awkward and so awesome. I'm pretty sure we just hung out with your family the whole time. Oh, this is the crazy thing. Okay, sorry, this is getting a total sidetrack, but it's fun. You were like, what should we do in town? And I was like, I don't know, let's go get ice cream. So I was thinking he was going to take me to like Cold Stone or yogurt shop. And no, we just went into Walmart and he bought a quart of ice cream. So then we left with our quart of ice cream, and then we had no way to eat it. And so we drove all the way back out of town to your brother's house so we could eat this ice cream. Anyways.
Growing up in a really rural community that doesn't even have a stoplight or a Walmart a fast food chain or anything, and then totally, and then just going to a place that's totally foreign to me, just my brain wasn't even like working, and I didn't even think, oh, we could go get milkshakes somewhere, or we could go get an ice cream cone. I was like, I don't know this city place. Anyways.
But after our first date, if this was our first date, he called me and you said, basically, hey, I'm dating to find a wife, basically. You're like, that's like my next step in life. I've done high school, I've done my mission, I'm going to college, and I'm like, my next step is to get married and have a family, because that's always what I've wanted. And I was like, same. That's all I've ever wanted either, plus I'm just ready for that anyway. And so you were basically like, great. If this works out, then we should get married. And this, I was like, yep, that's right. That's what we should do. Like,
I basically said, if me and you continue to date each other and things are going well, you just need to understand that it's going to end up with us being married. And that's the expectation of and the reason why we're dating.
And I was like, I completely understood that. It made sense to me. Now looking back, I'm like, oh my gosh.
We were so young. Yeah.
We were so young and so cute and naive, but oh my gosh, what a fun time. But yeah, we dated like through November and through the bulk of December. And then I think around Christmas time, we were already trying to talk about marriage. We were like, okay, like we really like each other. We like spending time with each other. We like all this stuff. I think I can see that this is going towards marriage. And then we're like, okay, we're both starting school again in January. At different schools, 2.5 hours away. And so I don't know if we were like for kicks and giggles or if we just felt like it was our obligation to go date around. What do you think? Because I think I felt like
the timing didn't seem right, because I really wanted to stay at Snow College. You had to SUU, even though I don't even know if you tried to tell me to come to SUU. I think I told you to try and come to Snow, which just doesn't even make sense. Yeah.
But yeah, we just...
But because of that, we were just like, let's make sure that this is what we want. So let's date a few other people. And
of course, since he's the boy and this was 2014 or 15 or whatever.
Not of course, since I'm the boy. Men now don't know how to ask people on dates
It was 2015, and so this still the expectation was yours. Like, it was your expectation to ask people on a date. But right. You're not shy. What, you went on plenty of dates. And then he would call me after his dates. I went on this date with this girl today. It was good. We did this. And then we kissed and she had a hairy lip. And so we broke up like that. But he would always call me and tell me about his dates. And I was just like, that's great. I'm not dating anybody because I'm the girl.
My thoughts were always towards you, Brittany, the whole time.
But I'm pretty sure that's maybe part of why I had talked to my bishop. Because, like, the bishop in that area, he would always meet with the young adults that would come in and get to know them and stuff. And I think I might have said, oh, gone on a few dates with this kid for my mission and I really like him, but I'm open to the idea of dating. And then he set me up on a blind date with a boy who was just so sweet, but just too sweet, you know? I like him a little naughty. A little naughty? I don't know. That's what I was trying to say.
You what?
I was just saying the boy was a little too sweet and maybe I like him a little naughty.
And if I'm a little naughty, I don't know what naughty is because I am so vanilla.
Oh my gosh, TMI.
But anyways, tell him what your bishop told you after you shared with him that you were dating me and that I was struggling with pornography.
Yeah. In my mind, I held ecclesiastical leaders to this, like, high regard and that they had a lot of good advice and all this stuff, which sometimes they do, but in matters of spirituality, not in matters of therapy. But basically, he told me that your pornography viewing was a red flag and that I should dump you right now. And that if I got married to you, that I would regret it later. And that has stuck with me. It hurt my feelings so bad. I really had a hard time with ecclesiastical leaders for a long time after that. Because I was just like, I really struggled with that. But anyway, so it was really hard because, and then me and you met with my bishop and you met with your bishop. And the experience was totally different. Yours was like talking about mercy and forgiveness and I knew in my heart that you were a really good person. And you know, would even tell me like how bad you felt about your pornography viewing. And I would like to say that I'm a righteous judge of character, but that I wasn't just kidding myself. But no, I really knew in your heart that you were a good person. And anyways, after much turmoil, we decided to go forward and get engaged. And that was in March. So we really only dated for about 5 months. And then we were engaged for 5 months and we got married in August. Anyway, that's our dating story. But so I have been aware of Colton's pornography viewing since before we were married.
And even after we had been married a few years, before I think we moved out to Arkansas, this would have been 2017, I'd met with our bishop at the time, told him I was dealing with it or struggling with pornography use. And great guy. He knows the scriptures, great teacher, but he literally told me that if I ever had this problem again, there would be a permanent black mark put on my church membership record.
And that made me upset.
And I remember one time I was still embarrassed to, my older brother had been a bishop for a while, and there was one time we were driving somewhere and I tried to make it sound like it was somebody that I knew who had been told this, but it was actually me. And he was like, what are you talking about? There's nothing like that. And he was literally a bishop himself. And I don't want anybody to listen to this and be like, wow, your guys' church sucks. I don't think there's any church that knows how to properly help somebody struggling with pornography because they just view it as a sin and that's it. They don't understand everything else that's behind it that we'll get into in a minute. But I also had one other bishop in high school tell me that once I repented of my pornography masturbation problem, if I ever turned back to it again, it was as if I had never repented. So there's like a lot of this pressure and this weight. Black mark on my church membership record. It's as if I've never repented in the eyes of God if I turn back to it again. My wife is going to always regret that she married me because I've struggled with this. And that's unbearable.
It's like shame with a capital S.
Yeah.
And then through the course of our marriage, pregnancy has been hard on my body, hard on my mind. And then just motherhood came with a whole or parent, I should just say parenthood, because for both of us, it just came with a whole nother can of worms that nobody really is equipped to deal with, but it really hit me hard. Postpartum hit me really hard, and enough that I was like, hey, I really need help. And then over the course of the last, now 8-9 years, I've been able to see therapists, be on medication, change medication, do all these things. And so I feel like Colton's view of therapy has been positive for the most part. But I do remember at some point saying, hey, I feel like this pornography use, like, it keeps cropping up, and I don't know if you're really equipped to deal with it by yourself. And so next time you feel like it's a really big problem, I want you to see somebody. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, I remember there was one time, I feel like we were at SUU, you told me if I struggled with again, or maybe it was before we moved out to Arkansas, you said if it ever came up again, that I at least for sure needed to go to the church's addiction recovery program meetings. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I'm never going to do it again because I don't want to go to these meetings. And anyways,
if that is going to change it.
Exactly. But I guess to finish off the story and get into the actual, like, really important part of what we're talking about, I had a really great 9-month period of sobriety in 2022. I thought things were just amazing. I felt like I made some strides. Looking back now, I realize I was just distracting myself. But the summer of 2023, it cropped back up again. Or in the early spring, I started viewing pornography again. And at this point, I'm about to turn 30. I've been married for 8 years. I have 3 kids. I just feel like I'm the biggest piece of junk husband and father on the planet. I feel like there's something wrong with me. I feel like there's something wrong with my brain. I feel like I'll never be able to change. I'll never be able to overcome this. And it just turned into a really vicious and addictive period for me in terms of my pornography use. And in the summer, I ended up making some decisions that I never, ever thought that I would ever make outside of viewing pornography use. And we don't need to go into the details of those, but what happened was I was compelled to be humble, and out of desperation to save my marriage with you and to not lose my relationship with my kids and even my own life, because I just was in this dark place that I'd never even been before in my life. Out of desperation, I reached out, I emailed a handful of therapists, and a couple of them got back to me, and I had one introductory call that you were there for, and then I was like, okay, I'm going to start meeting with this person. And that's how I started getting into therapy. At this point, I just knew I had tried everything. I had read scriptures and prayed hard enough, and that didn't help. I had read all sorts of books and literature, listened to podcasts. I hadn't ever gone to the recovery groups, but after starting to do therapy, I did start to go to some recovery groups, and there were helpful things. But again, all of those external things I found didn't do anything to help me with my pornography use. And so this is really where my journey started, and I was able to dig in deep to, like, my background and upbringing and childhood and make sense of all of these things instead of... And I had to do this because what I had been telling myself about who I am and what kind of person I am didn't help at all with the pornography use, and it wasn't true. And one of the things that I learned is my parents were awesome. They worked really hard to provide for our family, which was 7 kids, and absolutely love my parents. But when I was a little kid, from what I remember, they were never there. Like, my dad worked in a coal mine, and he was constantly working graveyard shift, swing shift, day shift, all these different shifts. And when he would come home, it was like, I have a couple of memories of him as a child on the weekend going up the mountains and hiking, or going on a snowmobile trip with him on a Saturday. But other than that, always gone. And when he was home, the rule was, we are absolutely quiet because he's sleeping because he worked graveyard. Mm-hmm. Or my mom, who was a registered nurse, working and gone all the time too. I just specifically remember me and my little sister just became the best of friends. And there was a lot of times in my childhood where I felt really lonely, and maybe something happened that made me feel hurt or broken, or I had an experience with some neighborhood boys or friends at school that maybe said something to me that was not appropriate or unkind, and I needed somebody to be there for me and comfort me. And when I, at the very moment that I needed it, I didn't have it, not because my parents couldn't provide it and that they didn't have the ability to, but just because they were gone.
Maybe they were home, but like you needed them like right in the very, very second.
Exactly. And
that can happen, because that happens to every kid. Mm-hmm. When they're at school, somebody says something mean, they're playing at a friend's house or they're at grandma and grandpa's house or something, and in the very, very moment that somebody needs them, they can't have it.
Mm-hmm. And I learned that even though I didn't have any, I wasn't malnourished, I didn't have parents that beat the crap out of me, or maybe we would argue that they made us work too hard, but it was like mowing the lawn and stuff and helping garden. It wasn't like traumatic. But that everybody has this little T trauma that I experienced, and it's normal, and that children are really resourceful. And this is when I started learning about IFS, or internal family systems, which is basically, in my mind, two parts. It's this type of work where you do parts work, and then there's this inner child work that you do. And the parts work, the way that I understand it and have learned, is there's the core person of who you are, and then, and that person's seated at the head of this family table, and then there's all of these other parts of who you are that are observing you from the outside and trying to help you and show up for you when they see that you need something or are distressed. And one of these parts of me when I was a child and in my early teens recognized that I felt something when I viewed pornography or was exposed to it that first time. And because I was resourceful as a child and a teen, and I needed somebody to nurture me and help me to self-soothe, essentially, it would recommend to me, let's go seek this out because it's going to help me to avoid these feelings of discomfort or loneliness or lack of connection or love or lack of just attention and someone showing up for me. And this stuff just started to blow my mind. And it also just made so much sense to me. And what happened is, as I got older and older, even though I was a little bit more confident with myself, this part of me that learned when I was a child and when I was in my early teens that its job in its mind's eye was to always direct me to pornography and masturbation anytime I felt those things. But as I got older, went on my mission, came home, started dating you, got married, started having kids, this part of me still thought I was literally a teenager it hadn't seen that I had grown up and matured, and it hadn't seen the effects of what it was doing in bringing this pornography and masturbation to the table to help me. And I do these meditations with my therapist, at least that's what I call them, but I do these parts work meditations and I do these inner child meditations. And the parts work meditations, it was interesting. The first time she told me during this guided parts work meditation to welcome this sexually acting out part to this family table, I was like, yuck, I don't want this person to even be there. And she was like, just be patient and just ask this part of who you are why it feels like it needs to do this job of having you view pornography and masturbation. And that's when I learned this part of me absolutely loves me. And it's always been there for me and just trying to help me when it's seen me struggling emotionally or all of these other things. And all it needed to know was that I'm in a different place than I was when I was a child or in my early teens. And to see that what it's doing actually doesn't help, but it's hurting more than it's helping. And as soon as it realized that and we had this conversation and we came to this understanding, it was just like, it felt so bad for doing this job that it learned to do when I was a child. And it's since learned to have a different job that provides meaningful things or positive or healthy things or ways for me to cope when I feel those types of emotions. But you have to do this at the same time you do the inner child work, because there's still inside of me, or there was, that little boy or that little teenage boy that had all of these experiences where he was hurt or broken and didn't have somebody to comfort him and show up for him when he needed it. And so in the inner child meditations, I'll go back to those memories and I'm able to sit down with that little boy, ask him what feelings he's experiencing, validate those feelings, let him know that it makes sense that he's feeling all those things and that it really is unfair that he's dealing with those things. And then I'm able to tell him, I'm always going to be there for you. And I'm able to encourage him and let him know just how amazing he is. And just how many lives he's impacted in a positive way, and just the joy that he brings to all the people that are around him. And when you go to therapy and you do this weekly, sometimes I go back to more than one of these memories and we just totally rewrite this memory, and it's the most powerful affirmation I've ever experienced in my life. Because I'll come out of the meditation and I'll leave therapy and I'll be driving home and I'll be like, holy crap, I actually am that person that I told that little boy he was. And it's hard to explain.
It's not hard to explain, because when somebody else is struggling, how much easier is it for us to go, it's okay, you're... Or if someone's, I'm a bad mom, it's so much easier to say, no, you're not. Look at all these wonderful things you do, blah, blah, blah. You're not a bad mom. Yeah. It's so much easier to tell somebody else that. It's really hard to tell ourselves that. You can look in the mirror and go, I'm a good mom, but it's really hard. But when you're telling a different part of yourself that they're a good parent, or that they're worthy or whatever, worthy of love, worthy of all these things, you're telling somebody else, but you're actually telling yourself.
Yeah, and that's just been so healing to me. And there's an apostle in the church that shares this analogy of what sin is. And It makes so much sense to me now, as well as, and I'll share this too, Elder Oaks said that sin is like, think of a tree that has branches and leaves, and in the wind, its trunk is so weak that it tips all the way over and the leaves get mud on them from the soil because of how the tree was bent and because of the weakness of the trunk. And he talks about how just cleaning the leaves doesn't do anything. The real thing that you need to fix and strengthen is the trunk. Mm-hmm. And once you heal the trunk and you reinforce it and strengthen it, the wind and the rain and the storms don't ever push it to a point where its leaves get in that dirt or that muck. And that's exactly what I feel like has happened to me. Also, with the Bible Dictionary under repentance, it talks about how the Greek word denotes a change, and it specifically says, I don't have it memorized, but it's like you have to develop a fresh view of God and of yourself and of the world. And until you do that, you're not going to be able to experience the other parts of repentance, because unless you change the way you view yourself and the way you understand how God views you, your understanding comes from the world, and it's a message of shame and unworthiness and imperfection and undeserving. It's all of those things. And so you really have to strengthen that trunk. You have to nourish and fortify that tree trunk through obtaining a fresh view about yourself and of God. And one other thing too in therapy that I've done is, and this seemed like the most impossible homework that I'd ever been given by my therapist, but one time she told me, your homework for this week is you need to go and write a letter to God. And she said, don't hold anything back. Tell him what you want to tell him. Let him have it, is the sense that she wanted me to have. And she said, then don't reread it. Wait 2 days. And then write a letter to you from God. And I was like, I'm not God. How am I going to do that? And it was easy to write the letter to Heavenly Father, but then a couple of days went by, and I knew I needed to do it, and I wanted to do it, but I was nervous, and I felt silly a little bit, but I just remember just closing my eyes and saying a little prayer in my heart that I could do this assignment, and all of a sudden I just envisioned through Heavenly Father's eyes his whatever elevation or foot view looking down on me, and just all of these words just started flowing onto the pages, and I was able to finish that assignment, and I learned and obtained a different view of God and of myself through that also. And there's just been so much healing, and I'm just in a place right now where, having struggled with pornography use and having been taught literally dozens and dozens of totally false things about how to overcome it and false things about who I am and what I am. And that's why I've been trying to, with your help, share some stuff on Instagram and whatnot, but something that I'm really passionate about. And I know that my story is going to help other people that are hurting and have been told what kind of people they are because they have a problem with pornography and who have been told that if they do this, it will fix it, and then they try it and it doesn't fix it, and then now they feel horrible, like really there's something wrong with them. I know that my story is going to help those people, and so that's why I'm wanting to share it. And the money that I've spent on therapy, I would do it a million times over again just because of how amazing it's been. Although there is one warning I would say, and there's a study that I purchased online that I can't remember who it's by, but they handpicked 11 couples and they interviewed all these candidates of these married couples who said that their spouse had a problematic pornography use. And they did a study on these 11 couples who had come out on top of it. And you'll have to put it in the comments or something. Anyways, it just highlights all the similarities between what these couples went through and how they got to a point where they've been able to overcome it. And one of the parts is they went and saw a professional counselor or a therapist. But when I read, I was almost in tears reading this one paragraph because several of the couples went to see a therapist or a professional. And my warning is not all therapists or professionals are the same caliber. And I know that this is how to heal and overcome this thing, but unfortunately, not everyone is created equal. And there's even some therapists or counselors that create more pain and hurt. And so you just need to be careful and make sure you find one with the right qualifications and credibility. Make sure they're recommended by somebody that you trust, that kind of a thing, before you just go in there and elevate them to this status that is going to be someone that's going to really be able to help you help yourself and then just have a terrible experience. And the reason that I just wept while reading that is because I got so lucky that the first person that I met with out of the people that responded to me was the person that I needed at that time in my life. And I just know that that's just another witness to me that God is in the details and he's watching out for me. He knows me and he was ready for me. And he had seen me suffer enough. And he was ready to provide me with the right way to find healing so that at this point in my life, stand up and be a bright light for other people who are struggling and in the dark of pornography use and shame from the world and help them to break through it.
Love you.
Thanks. And I'm just indebted to you for sticking with me through all this, and I'm just so thankful and lucky, and there's not a lot of women that would have stuck with me the way that you have. And I never, if you would have asked me a year ago if we were going to be sitting here and you were going to be recording me to be on your podcast talking to me about my pornography use and problem, I would have been like, you're literally about to leave me.
For the record, I didn't stay with you because you're not abusive. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's so many other women that go through similar circumstances or whatever, but are just being treated terrible. Mm-hmm. And it's not like we always agree on things, or we've had our fair share of lots and lots of tears and a little bit of shouting and things that were said that weren't really meant. But I just feel it's easier for me to discern where your heart is. I don't know.
I've only been married to for 9 years, but I just feel like I've been able to see that from the beginning, even before we dated, even when we like served in the same mission. It was just really easy to tell what your character was. And I just feel like, here's my crippling anxiety coming in, but I just feel like, I just feel like I turned into the exact opposite, where I feel like you maybe thought you knew my character, and then all of a sudden, I like came into marriage and I was just like, just kidding, I'm not who I am. I'm just a mess. But so I appreciate you sticking with me through all of it too.
Mm.
But we just need to wrap up this episode, but I'm sure we'll do another one, because I got asked to speak at this women's retreat, like this spiritual women's retreat this weekend. It's actually tonight. I have to go. I've got to finish some stuff up before we go. But when they asked me to share my story, I was like, I am honored that you'd want to know my story, but it needs to come with a disclaimer. I'm in the middle of it right now. Mm. There's like the light at the end of the tunnel is there, but I'm still in the middle of it. I'm still in the middle of the tunnel. And so I'll share my story, but it's not over yet. So I'm sure we'll do another episode or something at some point, or even just sharing more of our perspective. But thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Love you.
Love you.
Thank you for listening to the Mama Retreat podcast. If you have a friend or family member that needs this message, please share. Join the discussion on Instagram at the.mama.retreat. We can't wait to hear from you.